Let's get corrupted. What is going on, everybody? It's your boy Joe with Meteoric Serpents coming back at you for another episode of the Kluber Corruption Podcast. Guys, I hope you're all doing super well this week. Another great week. I checked out the, you know, just before we get into stuff, I went to the White Plains Expo today, which I should have said on the show last week so that people knew about it or knew that I would be there. But yeah, now that I'm back in New York, I got to check out a local show. That was always my home show growing up. I probably haven't been there since like 2018 though, which I didn't move, you know, that long ago. I moved in 2021, but it was good to go back and check it out. You know, it reminded me again of like the common Florida shows that I was, you know, used to seeing over the last couple of years. So, but either way, good to be back. At a home show, got to meet some cool people, some potential Kluber Corruption guests, which is always fun. So yeah, just very exciting. If anyone was there and I didn't get a chance to see them, I'm really sorry. I was walking around, I was there for the first few hours and then I kind of left. I grabbed a couple supplies, kind of things I needed. But that was really about it. But, yeah, guys, welcome again. This is episode number 62 of the Kluber Corruption Podcast. We have on tonight Brooke Elder. Really excited to have her on. We were due for a dry market episode. So, yeah, just really excited to get into things. And we'll get her on in just a few minutes. But, guys, if it's your first time listening or you've been here before, make sure you hit that like button on today's show. Make sure you hit the subscribe button on the channel. We are getting very, very close to 1,100 subscribers, which is awesome. Thank you guys so much for all the support. It really means a lot. And if you don't like listening on YouTube, you can listen to this on all the major audio podcasting platforms like Apple, Spotify, things like that. If you do, make sure you go leave a 5-star review and, you know, write a little blurb or something about how you like the podcast. Share the show to your friends, you know, get it out there to all your friends and help out the algorithm there. So, yeah. But you guys have been putting on so many views on the show lately. It's just it's awesome. And I really appreciate it. Also, guys, let's see. You could also follow me on all the major social media platforms if you want to stay up to date with what's going on. I know I haven't posted anything on Instagram, really, besides the podcast the last few weeks. Just everything's a little crazy with the move and stuff, so I haven't taken good pictures. Can't really go outside to take pictures. It's a little too cold here. So, but yeah, we'll get back to that soon enough, I promise. But it's at Meteoric Serpents pretty much everywhere. You could go check out my Morph Market as well. I don't have any animals posted on there, unfortunately. But yeah, check us out on Morph Market everywhere you can. Also, guys, make sure you support USARC, USARC Florida, the organizations that fight for our rights to keep our reptiles, fight against legislation that could be happening in our own, you know, local backyards. So yeah, make sure you support USARC. Finally rep the shirt. I do it every so often. Also, guys, the Meteoric Serpents Patreon is the first link in the description below. If you want to get a little more behind the scenes of what's going on here in the collection, I talk a little more on there than I'll probably post publicly or sometimes say on the podcast instead of a quick blurb. You get a little more interaction from me. It's also a cool Discord group chat with a bunch of people who are just into keeping Kluberd. So feel free to join that. If you also want to do like a one-time donation or whatever you want to call it, you could throw a super chat in the live chat. That'll show up on the screen here. So yeah. And then before we get into it tonight, we got our hashtag Kluber Corruption of the Week. And I actually had this one pre-picked like a good podcast host is supposed to. We got PJ with a couple of Barents racers. Posted this last week. Make sure you guys go follow PJ Cohn on Instagram. You'll get to see some cool workout videos and some cool snakes. but yeah, some nice green Barents racers. Just some really, nice quality animals. But yeah, guys, and once again, if you want to be featured, just put hashtag Hollywood Corruption on your Instagram posts, and I choose a new post every week. So yeah. But yeah, I guess that's all we have for that. Without further, oh, actually, let's say what's up to the chat real quick. We got Reptiles and Oddities. That's awesome. Hope you find some cool stuff. You can find some Texas rats in Louisiana. I know that. I guess they're Louisiana rats. Quirky. I am on Long Island. So yeah, that's cool. I grew up in Queens originally. If you guys didn't know that, I've probably said it a billion times, but originally from Queens, went to Florida, and now I'm back up here. We got Keller in the building. What is up, Jason? And we have Andrew. What's up? All right. But without further ado, let's bring our guest on for tonight. Once again, we are welcoming Brooke. Hey, what's up, Brooke? How are you?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. So yeah, like I said, the podcast was long overdue for a Dry Marcon specialized episode. But yeah, before we get into all of that and what you're keeping on that side of things, for anyone who doesn't really know who you are, can you kind of give your background into reptiles and how that kind of got you to where you are today with your collection and everything?
Yeah, so it's been a really long time I've been into reptiles, so I'll try to make it like short and sweet. But essentially, I grew up like catching frogs and garter snakes in Wisconsin, where I was born and raised. And then when I was 12 years old, I started working at a fish store. And then when I was 16, I got a job at like a legit pet store, and I started working in the fish and reptile department because they were like combined essentially. And with that, like being connected, I kind of got more intrigued by the different types of reptiles that were in pet trade at the time. And I fully like immersed myself in learning about different things. And like one of the first snakes I fell in love with was an Erangia carpet python. So I had one for a little bit. My parents never liked reptiles, and they still aren't very supportive of my endeavors. So I never was able to keep stuff like long term. I was able to like sneak it for a little bit, and then I'd get caught. Yeah. And then have to like go rehome it. I always found good homes for them. It was just, I always kind of like experimented. And then I went to college, brought my tegu to college. He lived in the dorms with me. And then when I graduated, I worked at a pet store in Muguanago that my friend owned. And he started importing a lot of different animals, just like Sheerlankan stuff, a bunch of different stuff from like Germany. Like we got Australian frilled, central netted dragons, a bunch of like little knobtail geckos, and just cool, different obscure stuff that I never thought I'd really work with. The Abronio that I worked with was really cool. So that kind of just like made me fully immerse into reptiles and just be like addicted to learning about different reptiles and just different pets in particular, because I always like worked in pet stores. So it always just, yeah, kind of like was something that intrigued me, was like what made the perfect like reptile pet, and like why those were always like the number one pets. And it was always kind of like my purpose. So like bearded dragons are like super popular, and Rankin's dragons are super awesome, and they stay a lot smaller. They don't need as large of enclosures, yeah, and they're exact same care. So I would always try to like push those types of animals onto people because they were easier just for like in means of like getting a big enclosure and setting it up. It was just, right, a lot to do for the average like pet person. And majority of people coming into a pet store are just like, they only have like one or two like reptiles at home. It's not like they have a whole like room full of them like other people do. So, and that's the majority of your customers. So, like you do get like those people that are very passionate and they do have like obscure things, but it's not always the case like with the pet stores. So I think that kind of just became like my passion of like educating people about these animals. Like I did children's birthday parties. I went to nursing homes. Oh, nice. I just did little education events that just like helped me spread like my passion for these animals, but also educate people that kind of didn't always like see reptiles as like a good creature. I've always just like loved the unloved, I guess. Any animal that makes you like work for their respect or like their trust has always just intrigued me a lot more than just like a dog that listens and does everything that it's supposed to is like great. But I always think it's fun to like learn what makes that dog tick, that's like getting into trouble or doing things that are necessarily like not good behaviors, but there's a reason for it. So I always just kind of like want to fix it and like learn how that animal ticks. Like if I could just like open up heads and like see like what's going on inside or what makes that animal tick, like it would just like, it just would be interesting to me because all of these animals, they are similar, but they like work in different ways. And it's always just been like really intriguing to me since I was little.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a similar story with working at a pet store. You know, I worked at like it was mainly fish and reptiles, but I always forget to mention what you just said about like educating people and especially people who don't know a thing about reptiles at all, or maybe only have one or two pets and they're trying a new species. It's such a integral part of the hobby is the education. I think that's why I like doing, you know, things like this and this show and you know, even reptile shows, because you get to do that for first time pet keepers, too. So, yeah, I think that's it's a fun part of the hobby that isn't talked about as much. It's just spreading the wealth of what we love, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's like really not talked about how much like it helps with the longevity of like the hobby in our industry, because even when I was an intern at the Milwaukee Zoo, part of my like internship was educating and speaking to the public and being there for people who had questions in the building. And I think that makes like such a difference, because like when it would come up for like building reviews, like the reptile and aquarium building, the Ark building, would always get the best reviews at the Milwaukee Zoo for people saying it was their favorite building. And it was because the animals were obscure and different, but they were also like able to learn about these animals and be immersed in seeing how these animals like behaviors were and just like how calm they were like around us keepers. Cause like when I would be cleaning the Cyclura lewisi in the morning, he would inevitably like climb up onto my lap at some point or try to like come and hang out with me. And like the public would see that and they would see like, oh, this isn't a big, like scary lizard. Like he's like a cat. He just wants scratches. And I think having that like good public eye helps us when like the votes do come up and issues do arise with people not treating reptiles good or not taking care of them well, because there's a whole community of people that do really take care of these animals and really are passionate about it, these animals, and don't see them just as like dollar signs or objects as other people portray them. And then they're not scary or dangerous like a lot of people can portray them at times with the whole like bite jump scenes and like scare factor, just for like that clickbait type mentality that it always is just going to look bad on the animals.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. Cool. All right. So you started with the tegu in the college dorm rooms, and then how did it evolve from there? Cause I know you have a much bigger collection than that now. Where did you go from there? I assume you graduated, or at least you're done with college. Now you have the ability to expand a little bit more.
So I was kind of an idiot in college. I had like a bunch of bugs and insects. I bred a bunch of like isopods, millipedes. And then I like worked with like jumping spiders and just different, like, I guess, inverts. I had mantises as well. But I ended up bringing home, I had a crested gecko, and then I ended up bringing home Natiri, my first indigo, in 2020. And that was because he was at a pet store that I was working at. And I went on vacation to Florida, I believe it was. And when I got back, he had really bad rot. And it like really bothered me, because I just like really like thought this animal was very impressive and beautiful. And it would bother me with any animal. It was just this animal in particular, I had kind of like had a like bond with, per se. Like I spent more time with him, so I just wanted to make sure he had like round the clock care. So I like brought him home, and I had to rehab him for many months. Like he didn't eat for 8 months. And then once he started eating, he like he's never stopped. But it was one of those things where I've always loved snakes, and I've always think they're like inquisitive and just like cool to be around. But working with an indigo, it just kind of like opened my eyes to a new like intelligence level or a cognitive ability that I guess I didn't always see in other species. Like I love Drymobius, for example, speckled racers, but they are flighty. They throw themselves at things. Like they just are kind of chaotic sometimes, where indigos, they like take a minute and they think about things a lot more. And you see that in just different species across the board. But it was something where I was like, okay, this guy has more going on upstairs. And I think I noticed it mostly when I was like doing his care, because I had to get all this like rot off of him and like pull old like shed off of him that was like built up. And he used to bite me all the time, and it was like a week in he stopped biting me and he would just like watch me. I was like, I've never had a snake like stare into my soul. Like I always just felt like I was like invading his like privacy by like, you know, like pulling at him and poking at him. But at the same time, like I had to do it to like help him feel better. So it was just like, I kind of felt like there was just a lot more going on upstairs, and it made me intrigued with the species overall. And then I just like dove into like the genus of Drymarchon in general. And I was just like, these are really fucking cool snakes. Like more people need to like know about them. And cause I think once I was like, I obviously bought him and like kept him, and I wanted to breed him eventually. So I started looking at females, and I just saw there wasn't that many people doing it. It was just like Black Pearl at the time, I think, when I like looked them up. So I was just like, huh, like these aren't a really popular snake. Like that's kind of weird. I was like, I don't get why more people like have them. And like at the same time, now that I do breed them and have them, I get why a lot of people don't have them. I think more people need to be educated on them. And then once they're educated on them, then they're going to be like, oh my gosh, like I need Drymarchon. But I think it is like one of those snakes that like, I am happy that people don't just like have them like crazy and dive into them like crazy, because it's a commitment animal.
Oh yeah. They're big. Think, you got to feed them a lot. You know,
they poop a lot. Like they move a lot. They are like a presence, but they're definitely like, I feel like if you have them in your collection, it's easily like one of your favorite colubrids in your collection. Like, and I think that's like across the board for a lot of people, just because they witness like how much of a presence this animal is. And they're just, it's a very powerful animal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm now only currently working with Rubidus right now. I would like to work with the Yucatans, the black tail Kribos, and then I would eventually like to work with Cupri. The thing is with the Easterns, they're ESA, so I could only sell like to in-state people. So I don't want to be like pumping them out by any means, but just to have a male especially would be just a really cool pet. I just want to give it a really big enclosure, because that's something where like I was talking to you off stage about, but I would like to give all my animals a lot more space. And I feel like that animal in particular should have like an 8x4x4 minimum as an adult, just because once you see them like in the wild or have the capability to climb and use the space, like they use every inch of it.
Yeah, definitely. So besides getting that first one, but what made, or I guess you kind of said it, but like what made you so drawn into the Rubidus as opposed to any of the others, and really expanding that piece of your collection and getting more of that species?
I feel like just the way they looked, like they were just like unique, and they come in like different like versions almost. Like there's more like mottled looks, there's more reds on some. They also have like the different localities of the Rubidus. So there's going to be your Veracruz, your Sonoras, and then your Gueros, which is what I keep. And so the just the variability between like those different ones or localities were just very intriguing to me. And I think I did get like really crazy at first, because I wanted like a Veracruz, I wanted a Sonora, and like I did end up like getting them. But then I had really bad like experiences with them. Just like one of the Sonora males, he had penostomes, so he died, like suffocated. And that was horrible to see. So it just like going through those types of experiences and then not having people I can reach out to and talk to about like their care or how to breed them or how to do these things. I was like, okay, I need to like chill out, focus on one thing, get that down. And then once I have that down, then I can expand. So like my rule of thumb with anything that I breed is all of that money will go, or majority of that money goes back into those animals. So if that animal produces and it has babies, then that animal that goes into their enclosure, or just like anything that comes along with like keeping them or their babies, like enclosures or upgrades and stuff, it just always goes back into the indigos. And I just think that's like really important because they're constantly giving to you. So it's important to give back to them as well. So that's why like staying focused and not getting all of the different dry Marcon, even though I think they're absolutely fabulous. I just thought that was the best for my like interest at least, to stay focused.
Yeah. No, I gotcha. And in terms of the specific animals you picked out, and have acquired in your collection, have you gone for any certain phenotypes or certain looks on the animals, or have you been kind of grabbing the best available ones you could? What's kind of, just because they're not available as much, so what's kind of been your game plan in terms of acquiring animals?
So oddly enough, it's just been like the rejects. I would go to different reptile shows and like find them on like flippers tables and stuff. And I would just be like, what are you doing with this snake? And like, they would always be like Mexican red tail indigos or Mexican crebos, like I'd see them labeled as. So I'd always just like look for them at shows because they do have like a different look to them than the other indigos as well, like with their eyeliner and everything. So it was really easy to just to be able to like spot them out. But with that being the way that I did things, I also went through like the harder route. Like I had two of mine have like hookworms when I got them. And they were like not in a good state when I got them. They like appeared decent at the show. Their noses would always be like rubbed. And I would just be like, okay, that could be stress from being in the enclosure, and it could also just be the stress of being at a show. Like they rub their faces really excessively when they are stressed. So it in all actuality could have done that like overnight just by being stressed out. So there was always like things where I would like let stuff go with the animal's like condition, like presented condition, because I would be like, oh, well, it could be like X, Y, and Z that happened. So it's not necessarily a sick animal. And so I did deal with that type of stuff, even though I didn't pay $2,000 for the animal. Like I still paid, you know, a lot of money, and it was then had worms, and then I'm going to the vet for stuff, and that cost then what it would have cost to buy like the captive bred babies from Black Pearl. I feel like I just have always liked the reject animals. And like I've always just liked helping the animals. Like I said, I like fixing stuff. Yeah. So I think it was just like really easy for me to just fall in love with the snakes like individually and not looking at like, oh, this color would look good with this like pattern or this or that. And then when it came to like pairing, as like hippie woo-woo as it sounds, I kind of went off of how the snakes responded to each other. And that's how I still do like my pairings today. Because like I did try like my different males with the different females, and I could just tell by the way the female responded, like if she liked one or she didn't. And then my one female who's like my best breeder now, she was the biggest pain in the ass because she would bite at the males and be really aggressive and defensive. And I finally just was like, you just have to get over it. And I put my more confident male in with her. And she beat the shit out of him like all night. She didn't bite him, but she would slap him into the wall. I've never seen a snake do this in my life, but she would go like underneath him and like uppercut him and hit him into the ceiling of the enclosure. Really? And was just punching him around, and he would just turn around and keep going at her. So I was like, okay, this is probably going to be a fit. And that's like been my best pairing. They produce like some of the highest reds that I have. And then like my other female who I paired to like my first male, She's more mottled, and then she gives me like the really high red, I like say like calico, like looking almost babies. Okay. And so, but the dad looks nothing. I mean, both of the parents don't look anything like the offspring. It's just those certain combinations. I feel like I'm just kind of like seeing what I get now that I have like those offsprings and holdbacks. I'm going to raise them up. I have them unrelated pairs. And I nice. Picked the pairings purposefully to like get the highest reds and the highest like modeling. Awesome. So hopefully it works, but I don't really know if that's how it works because I haven't had enough experience. I just have two males and three females right now that are all proven breeders. The rest are holdbacks.
Very cool. Yeah, we're definitely going to show off some of the animals in your collection just off of your Instagram. But before we do that, I kind of just want to go through the basics because, again, just haven't had a lot of dry marking conversation on the podcast, at least in a while. But can you kind of go through, I guess you could kind of give generals from like baby to adult, how all your general parameters, temperature, you know, substrate that you use, cage enclosure size, as you scale them up, can you kind of give a breakdown of everything you do for that species?
Yeah. So when they're babies, they either go in like these little 12 quart like hefty totes with lids that I have like them all pre-drilled and everything, or they'll go into like a baby rack. Sometimes I just feel like the shoebox like size can be like a little small for them because like they do like to like explore, but some of the babies, like I think dry Marcon in general, are just shy as babies, and then like once they have a few meals in them, that's when they start to get the confidence in them. So like some are more confident than others coming out of the egg, so you kind of just like feel for it. If I have picky eaters, I use silver sides to scent like pinkies, or I just feed them silver sides and they love silver sides. That's generally, I don't think I've ever had a baby like refuse food, especially like with the silver sides. And like I said, once they have like, I would say like three meals in them, like good meals, like they're just like hooked on food. Like they kind of just like realize like this is what I have to do to exist. Throughout the board with temperatures, I keep them all the same. They're usually just like room temp. I never let them get over 90. Like if we did have like a heater on or something, like I would just never let them go higher than that. Generally at like 88 degrees, they'll start like rubbing their face, especially if they're in like an enclosure. Now outside, indigos have been seen basking at like 90 and sometimes even hotter. But I think it's just the thing is like they're in a box and they can't get away from the heat. They can't thermoregulate in other ways. That there's not like a breeze going on. There isn't just like different factors that I think like the natural environment gives. So I try to just never let them go over 88. When I do get them ready for like breeding season, I'll let it crank up. Like the basking spot does get to 90, but it's only like for an hour it'll get that hot, and then it's off. It's like 4 hours a day like their heat source is on, and then the rest of the time it's off. And that's only a couple months out of the year, I would say, because I take them out of brumation in January and I heat them up slowly. I just make the house get cooler, so it's not like I pull them out and put them in totes and put them in a room to cool them. I know Steven does that with like his Pituophis and stuff, or like his Blue Beauties and whatnot. I just don't do it with them. I never really had to, because when I lived in Wisconsin, like my house just got cold in the winter. Yep. So it was just like I was able to let them drop to like 60, 65 at night and never have like any issues. Obviously they go off of food, but that's only for a couple of months. And I start cooling them down in October, the end of October usually. And then I wake them up in January. Usually it's like the second week of January. And then I start, you know, feeding them more, putting their basking spots on for 4 hours a day and just start watching for activity. A lot of the times, you'll know that your males are like ready for season before your females are ready for season. The males like kind of wake up and they'll just be like rubbing their faces and they just want to get out and look for those ladies. So you do have to just like slowly feed the females. They'll usually go through like a shed cycle and then they're ready to accept the male. But it's really crucial, I think, to like give them the space. Cause like this year, I think I pushed my one smaller female too early. And I think that's why now she's kind of like delaying for me, because I needed to let her just get a few more meals in her before she was ready to just even entertain a male. Right. And, you know, food's going to help them develop follicles and know that it's ready for season and stuff. So I think she just was kind of delayed and it was my own doing. Cause I was just so focused on this one female in particular. And I kind of just like, just didn't judge the situation like I should have. And so I learned, like, it's always a learning experience with them. That's typically, how their breeding season goes. Sorry, I'm like all over the place, but general care for temperatures, always the same, humidity. I usually keep them about, it fluctuates. So it'll be like 30% humidity sometimes. And then other times it'll be like 60%. And that's only for like an hour or so, like throughout the day, that it would get like that high. And then they all have like lay boxes. I think you can see this one behind me.
They
all have these totes that they go in, and those have sphagnum moss in them. So I just always keep those sprayed too. I would assume that they're always at like 40 to 60% humidity, sometimes maybe a little bit more if I like just spray it. But that's generally what I keep at, especially if a female's like going into shed or whatever, that just helps get the perfect shed. Otherwise you're going to get like the split shed pieces instead of like the full body, like tube that can come off with indigos. I see like Drymercon in particular have like split sheds like quite a bit in people's care. And I think it's just because they don't really know when to spray. Cause like, you don't want them to have like stagnant humidity by any means. But they also, they love drinking water. So they do like big water dishes. They absolutely love drinking water. They don't soak. They will soak if they have mites, but they just like having access to fresh water all the time. And then humidity, like what I do for like the shed cycle is I spray them pretty much every day when they're going into shed. As soon as they go normal, I back off. I give them like a couple like hours throughout the day. I'll check on them again. As soon as I see like that shed like pop on them a little bit, I'll do like a light mist, because like I get like the wood pieces and the different stuff in there wet. So when the shed is coming off, it just like, it catches easier than when it's like dry. And then it just helps like pull that shed off perfectly for the animal. Cause indigos, they have such big eyeballs that like, if you don't do it properly, like they'll always get like a stuck eye cap just because their humidity isn't right. And I think people will sometimes spray them way too much and then it gets stuck because it's just like a wet, like swimsuit, just like stuck to you. And then when you do like that perfect amount of just like spraying as soon as you notice that animal go into shed like every single day, and then backing off right when that animal goes like normal, is just like the best way to like ensure that like they have humidity, but you're not like blasting them with humidity, because they're also very like susceptible for upper respiratory infections when you do too much humidity and have no airflow. They just have a sensitive upper respiratory for just like a North American colubrid or Mexican species of colubrid, but I always just like kind of clump them in with the North American couperi.
Yeah.
It's just like easier, even though they are more like South American, Mexico, they're all over. But I just think that works best for the Mexican indigos in particular. And I would assume it would be the same for like the Florida and the Texans. I don't know. I would assume Curibos can handle like higher humidity as well.
Yeah,
but again, with all those species, you want to give them good airflow,
right? Yeah. And then kind of going back to size, just again, because I know you keep like very nice enclosures for all your animals, so you start them in that 12 quart. What's your general way of scaling them up? And so, what would be their like final destination in terms of an enclosure size?
So if you're going to reach out to me and like you want to keep an indigo, I'm going to tell you to keep it in a 6x2x2 at least as an adult, because that should just be like the bare minimum. I do breed them and I am limited on space. So I have them in 4x2x2s, which is like perfectly good for anything like 2 years old and up. They're going to like thrive in that space. I think 1 year olds will use a 40 gallon, like they'll use every inch of it. I raise my, okay. at once they're off of like out of the baby size and they're around like 6 months old, I will put them in enclosures that are like 2 foot. I think they're 2 foot by 18 inches by 12 inches tall. And the babies will go in there for about a year, I would say. It's kind of like, I always just like watch my animals. The indigos, like they're really smart. So like when an indigo wants an upgrade, they'll literally start pushing all of their substrate and all of their stuff to the back of the enclosure. And it always makes me go like, what are they doing? But that means like they want more space to like do things and like they like to climb and they like to explore. So when I start to notice that with a snake, like I'll upgrade them. And then as soon as I upgrade them, like they stop doing that behavior because they have different enrichment and places to go and be. So I would say like if you had a pet indigo, like if you got a baby from me and you took it home, like you could raise it in a 36-18-18, like a 40 gallon, and like that would be perfect for at least like a year and a half. And then when it's like 2 years old, you could definitely like move it up to the 4x2x2, and then they'll just like grow into it. If you wanted to do a 2 year old in a 6x2x2, you can do it. Just build up different spaces for it and just know that like they're a burrowing species. So like if you do provide them with a lot of space and you do want to like take them out or move them, if they are like sleeping or doing whatever indigos do, like you're not going to find them like in a big enclosure. If they are like smaller, it's just going to be a lot harder, especially with like the decor and everything. Like I love doing the decor for my animals, but like I always tell people, yeah. like on a large scale, like I feel like it is like impossible because you literally have to like pull the wood out, spot clean like underneath the wood, like pick stuff off the like the leaves, like the indigo's like shit everywhere. So like they're yeah. gonna like put it everywhere regardless. So you have to do a lot of moving in the enclosure. So I can't do like those fake like rock backgrounds and stuff for them. Like if it was my only snake, yes, I could 100%. I just cannot keep up with like the cleanliness of like scrubbing like fake rock walls and all of these different yeah. decor objects that like people have for like certain species. Will they use them? 100%. Is it practical for me because of how many I have? No. But I always like promote like people to do those things if they are just like keeping one indigo or they are just keeping yeah. like a few animals, because like it's gonna give the animal more like enrichment and make them feel more secure. You won't find that animal like wanting to get out of its enclosure all the time. And indigos, this is something that I find funny about them. If they poop, they want out of the enclosure. So like anytime like I can tell like if anyone's pooped, it's because like all three faces will be like at the front of the glass. And okay. then I know to like go do like poop changes that day. And then as soon as I do clean up their poop, they generally like sometimes they'll come out and hang out for a little bit, but other times like they don't want anything to do with me. They just wanted me to like clean up their poop. So I think that's kind of funny with them because you can like do free choice handling with them to agree, but like they kind of fake you out a lot of the times because like majority of the time they've pooped and they just want to get away from their poop. They don't really care about you. So yeah, the babies, like I said, raise them in 40 gallons. You can go smaller, but I think if you just have one indigo, to raise them in a 40 gallon is great. You can raise them in racks. I would only raise them in like CV70 tubs. Anything smaller is just like a disservice to that animal. And like try to go clear if you can, because they're so visually orientated that if yes. you take that away from them, you're going to get a completely different animal. They're just so much more reactive. They just act way different. I don't really know how else to like describe it than like I should probably like show it in video sometimes, but like my one female that I still have for sale. She's still in the rack and she's two. And as soon as I open it, she just comes out like swinging because she just thinks it's always like food or just like something is going on. Like she's just way more like defensive, I would say, or just like just jumpy. And then the babies that I've like are my holdbacks and they're out here in cages and the 2-footers, they are much more thinking before they react. And that's way more on par for how an indigo's actual behavior is than this reactive one that's in the rack that's just like swinging at everything. And I think that's why indigos got a bad rap is because a lot of people that do keep them and breed them, they keep them in racks. And they're not dumb animals, so like they associate, oh, they're opening the tub, they might be feeding me, because 80% of the time you are feeding them. So they just associate it with that, and then they'll catch people slipping sometimes. And it's not, the animal's not a crazy animal. It's just, it's a product of its environment.
100%. Yeah. And going off of the last comment in the chat there, feeding is something I wanted to talk about because I know one, dry Marcon have super high metabolisms. You feed them a lot, but you could also feed them a super varied diet because they are just such voracious eaters. So I kind of want to know, what is your routine? You kind of mentioned like pinkies and silver sides, especially for babies, but what is the variety mix you like to give? How do you do it? How do you prepare it? And all that stuff.
So to answer the one comment, I tong feed everything. I just like the interaction with the animals. If the animal isn't having it, then I just like leave the food like on its like hide or something. But I always like place their food like in different parts of their enclosure so they have to like work for their food, because indigos have like an amazing sense of smell. So like it's just an enrichment for the animal rather than just like setting their food there for them and they just like know where it is all the time. Because they are smart and they'll like know like where you usually feed them and stuff. And I know people say that when you like tong feed or like interact with them, they can be like more like food happy, but they are smart enough that like if I touch my animal and I'm not like holding food, like I touch them on their back end and like I'll use like the back of a hook or something, or I'll just use my hand sometime and just like grab them, because like I know the way that the animal's sitting, it's not going to be in a defensive posture. But they're smart enough to know the difference of when you're feeding them and when you're not feeding them. So if you do tong feed them and interact with them, it's not going to cause an issue with handling, because as long as you present yourself in a way of like, this isn't a feeding moment, and you don't hesitate or you don't do anything stupid, the animal is going to be completely relaxed and know it's, you're not feeding them. And it's just, its mentality will be completely different. They're just smart enough to know that. So for like diversity, I feed rodents sometimes. So mice and softers. I do rats like here and there. I just try not to do a lot of rats because I think rats create like lazy breeders sometimes. There are like definitely times where I'm like, yeah, like it's needed to get a good meal on this animal and just like a solid like hunk of meat in this animal. But then there's other times where I'm just like, if I feed them, you know, 5 like large mice, now is that more expensive? Yes. But sometimes it's just like, I think better for the animal because they're still getting a good sized meal on them, but it's not like bloating them, or they're not taking multiple days to like really digest it or break it down. And then they're also still getting like the nutrients that they need. So it's not like harmful for the animal. But I just see that it makes my breeders like less lazy when they get like smaller meals, but like more frequently. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't feed them rats like ever, because they do get them sometimes. I've even fed mine like rabbit pups. But you just don't want to do it all the time. Otherwise, like that snake, I've noticed at least with other like people, especially with the Texas indigos, they're just like, oh, they're not breeding. Oh, they're not doing this. And it's like, well, they're fat. Like, if you're trying to get something to like move around and be active or like have like libido, like being overweight isn't going to do it. It's just going to lead to an overall lazier animal, like in captivity. So like for my females, when they're eating more frequently, they'll go between the mice, the softers, and then chicks and quail, if I can get like access to quail. And then frog legs were a big one for them. I usually do frog legs when they come out of brumation, because in Mexico, from what I've read, there's like a big rain, and then frogs produce, and then they come out and feed, and that like starts their breeding season. So I kind of just like did it with them to like replicate what I could in captivity of what their natural cycle would be, even though they are like captive animals. It's just all animals, regardless of them being captive bred or not, they're going to have instincts. So if I can invoke those instincts in any way possible, I'm going to try it. And I think it did really like set those females up then to be like, okay, like, let's go. Like, we're eating, we're getting sprayed, humidity's higher, like, let's get this started. And I think that was a good variety for them. I also gave them a bunch of different fishes, and then I would go and get like different like duck necks, chicken hearts, chicken gizzards. I would get quail, like whole bodied quail. I would feed those to like my tegu mostly. Okay. But I would just try to do like leaner protein, like varieties, like more obscure meats that aren't like heavily like farmed or like mass produced, in the fact that they're like not as like healthy. And that's why like I don't like to do like a lot of chicken with any of my animals, just because of how like heavily like produced they are. But if it comes to like organ meat and different stuff, those contain like different vitamins and minerals that are beneficial. And it's not just like giving them like a drumstick. And I think it's just a lot more healthy for the animal to like have those varieties. And it just keeps like, I think it just keeps the animals just like more well-rounded and more just like versatile to things. Like,
yeah,
as weird as that is. But like, I hear so many people always just be like, oh, this snake only eats rats, or oh, this snake only eats birds and this or that. And I'm like, well, like, have you made them eat other stuff? And I just don't think a lot of people do that. And then
right,
when they try it, they're like, oh my gosh, like, this is crazy. Cause like, I fed mine snail meat, I fed them quail eggs. I feed them anything that like I have to feed the other reptiles that's left over that I know like is healthy for them. Like, I'll feed it to them just to try. And even though only one of my females ate the snail meat, at least all of them got to at least like experience it and smell it and see if they wanted to try it. They had that option rather than like not. And I think that's just like, it makes for like a happier animal in captivity, because it gives them something different. It's not like they look forward to it, but it's like, it's not like I'm just presenting them with a rat every week and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, they have to smell it. They get to smell new things. They get to experience new things. And I think it just gives them a better disposition in captivity. So variety, I just think, is very, very key. And you shouldn't be scared to try anything. The fish, I just do raw. Everything I do raw. I don't boil or bake anything. I think you should always just use caution. And when you're picking up their poop, use gloves. Like, if you are worried about any type of like salmonella, if you were feeding like different types of chicken or stuff, just be careful, like cautious with like that stuff. Be clean. And you shouldn't really have a negative experience with feeding them variety. I need to get it on film, but I was a dog trainer. Initially, like, once I graduated high school, I got certified to be a dog trainer, and I worked with like shy and reactive dogs. But anyways, puzzles are a big thing for those dogs, for just stimulating their brain, working on like displacing aggression or anxiety. Like, those types of mental stimulation games are just really good for them. So I heard people like say Drymarcons like were smart, and they knew how to like do puzzles and this and that. So I was like, okay, like, let's try. And I did put fish, chicken hearts, a mouse, and a quail egg in one of like the tornado puzzles. And my one female, she did move it and eat it. I just need to do it with my one female who's not like camera shy, because my two females, if I try doing anything like that with them, they look at me like I'm Satan. So it would either be the males or the female, the one female that I could get to do. But they just have so much going on upstairs, and you can see that, like, when they're smelling, it's they're not excited, but it's like that animal's just like they have just, it seems like excitement. They're just like, they're taking it all in. They're experiencing life, and it's just, it's interesting to see, just like putting those different food objects or making them work for it. Just seeing the gears turn in their heads.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, it's been said before on here and just in general, like Drymarcon are some of the most intelligent snake species out there. And I haven't had the pleasure of keeping a truly intelligent snake species. I think most of mine are on the dumber side, if I had to put it one way. I mean, it's really so interesting hearing people's experiences and especially things like that with the feeding and just their general behavior. So that's super cool.
Yeah, I think like what I attribute it to is, so like all snakes are like predators to like a degree. They are prey for some things, but indigos are kind of like one of the top dogs in their areas, essentially. Yeah. Like they eat venomous snakes. They really don't have a lot messing with them because they are smart. They know how to like look for birds and be more elusive, and they just are paying attention more. And I think that just comes down to like that individual animal, the instincts and stuff. And it doesn't mean like the snakes like you have, or like the Pituophis, for example, it doesn't mean they're stupid. It just means where they're from, they aren't really, they are a top dog, but not the top dog. And right. I think with some of these reptiles, they are the top dog where they're from. And so they just present themselves in a different manner. And then they exhibit just like an intelligence level in a different manner, where it's, I'm trying to like say, not, these animals aren't dumb, and these animals, like, they do have a purpose.
It's okay. I have ball pythons. They're pretty dumb. So a lot of times
I just try to like tell people like the animals are all like built off of like where they're naturally from. Even if they are like captive bred for like generations, so they're going to act like instinctually, and these animals have to exhibit these certain behaviors to stay alive. So certain animals that where they are from like naturally, and they don't have a lot of predators, they're going to present themselves differently than an animal that is under constant like threat because it's got predators all around it.
Right. Cool. I'm going to pull up your Instagram here just to show off a few of your animals. And perhaps while we're doing that, we could kind of talk about what you've done breeding wise over the last few years. Cause this first one I'm pulling up is a holdback of yours from 2023.
Yeah. So I've only had 3 clutches of indigos like since I started breeding, which was 2022 was when I got my first clutch, and then I got 2 clutches after that with 2 different females, and then I moved just a couple years ago, so I've been just getting everyone back to normal before I start breeding them again. They're just very sensitive with like moving, and I think like it's just kind of a duh, because any animal you move cross country, you know, 20 some hours in a vehicle, it's going to throw them off for a bit.
Yeah.
And then they also weren't able to be like set up. So they were kind of like moved around the house in different spots. So I think it just took them a while to like adjust to their surroundings and not be constantly stressed out. So this year, hopefully I will have more clutches and continue my journey with these guys. Awesome. I also breed your Eurydactylodes agricoli, the Bowers chameleon geckos. I've been breeding those since I was out of college. So probably around like the same time as like when I started getting the indigos in like 2020. Was kind of probably when I started getting like my chameleon geckos and then raising them up to like be breeders. I now have four groups of 1.3 breeding groups that like I'm working with. And then I'm also trying to breed my rhinoceros iguanas. So Rocco and Rockette.
Those are your main thing, I'll call it, especially social media wise. We're going to talk about those guys for sure.
Rocco definitely forces himself to be my main my main attention because he's just always doing ridiculous stuff every single day. I always think it's so funny because like I do love lizards. Like lizards are my thing, but I do have more snakes than I have lizards. But I think that honestly attributes to like the lizards just need so much more. And a lot of my snakes do, like 9 of my snakes are indigos. So like, you know, like those do make up a good portion of what I have. But like, yeah, big lizards, like big chunky lizards are just like my favorite thing. Not chunky in like an unhealthy way. I'm super.
Yeah, of course.
Anal about like how much they're like fed, and I really do like watch all their weights, especially like my tegu, because they're like prone to obesity just as a species, because they're omnivorous, but they do need like protein, but you just want to make sure you're not giving them like fatty protein, because then they just get fat. And that's the one thing like I love about Morpheus, is he is the calmest like best boy ever, but like if you got food, he will come out flying, and he can jump really high, and he's just got like this amazing like force behind him, and you just don't really see that with many like captive tegus, because they're just like so fat they can like barely move. But I always say Rocco needs to leave him be, because if Morpheus wanted to, he could snap Rocco in half probably.
Yeah, I'll never say never, but I probably won't ever have one, but I've always been so enamored by the black and white tegus. I think they're just such a cool animal, just their whole body structure, the way they are. Just their whole thing about them. I don't know. I've always really liked them a lot.
I think they're awesome. I think they got kind of ruined by the pet trade for just a bit, and with everything that went on with like Florida and the ban and stuff. Because I think so many people got them and they just like weren't prepared for them. And they like saw videos of them being like puppies on camera. So they expected them to just like be like that right away. And that's something like I try to tell people with lizards all the time, is like, they don't owe you anything, and they're going to make you work for that relationship with them, because again, they don't owe you anything. You're the one that went and bought them. You're the one that has to feed them and clean their shit and do everything for them. So you kind of just have to like let them accept you on their own terms. That doesn't mean you just like leave them be. But it means that you respect their surroundings and their space, and you give them time. Because these animals go through, you know, sexual maturity around, you know, 2 years old with tegus, and then around 3 and 4 with like the rhinoceros iguanas, and they turn into completely different animals. Like they're hormonal. They're supposed to eat like crazy because they have to get ready for season. It's bulking season. So they're just like these little hormonal, not little sometimes, but they're just very hormonal and agitated, and they don't really know how to be comfortable in their own skin. And when you try to like put your own feelings onto them and be like, well, I love them and I'm there for them and I'm not trying to hurt them, like their brain isn't thinking that way. They're just thinking, I need to eat, I need to stay alive and get ready for breeding season because I have a job to do. That's just like how their brains are. So as long as you can get past that, like Morpheus is 6 years old in July and Rocco's 9 years old. And I think both Morpheus more than Rocco, but they just chill out. They're used to the hormonal fluctuations at a certain point. Like he still cycles for season. Like he still is like sniffing and rubbing his feet and looking for a lady. during like his breeding season, but he's not lunging at me with his mouth open. He's not agitated if I touch his back. He's not agitated if I'm like in his space. Where like three years ago, especially, he'd light me up if I even tried to like fix a light bulb in his enclosure when he was in there. So, and then when you took him out, he was completely fine and he'd just walk around and be a hormonal teenager rubbing his feet and his giblets everywhere. But it definitely, like I tell people, if you have the patience and the time and you have the money, because they eat a lot, and their cages cost a lot of money and their lighting is a good amount of money as well. If you have all of that, then they're the perfect pet. But if you just are fantasizing because you see one on the internet or like on someone's social media and you think, oh my God, that could be such a great pet, but aren't really mentally prepared for all the other stuff that goes in it, just take a little bit longer, think about it a little bit longer.
That's the thing. Those big lizards, they are a commitment. And I've had conversations with people on here about it. Like even bearded dragons are a bigger commitment than I think most people realize. But like, you know, the big lizards like iguanas and tegus and stuff like that, they're basically dogs. Like they're as close mm-hmm. you could get as a reptile version of a dog.
I feel like I compare them to like birds, like big parrots a lot.
Yeah.
Just because of how much like interaction and time they do need, like they need that mental stimulation. Otherwise you're going to have like an agitated lizard or pet. Where like a dog, like to a degree, like certain breeds, especially like you need to exercise and you need to like do those things. But there are like certain dogs where you can just feed them, treat them, and they just like sleep all day and you really don't have to like do that much. Where like this animal is going to be like demanding your attention. It's not going to be screaming like a parrot, but it's going to be scratching. It's going to be just like letting you know that like it needs something and it needs to come out. And then they poop like crazy, so because they eat a lot, because they have fast metabolism. So like it's like having a puppy, maybe, like, I would say more than, like, an adult dog. Like, if someone were trying to get into it. But it's not going to be affectionate like a puppy. And people need to know that, too. So I guess that's why I kind of do just, like, strongly, like, compare them to birds. Because you have to work for that bond. And then you can still treat them and love them and everything, but if you don't give them that like enrichment and stimulation where like you are letting them out and do those things, like you're just not going to have a happy animal in captivity.
Right. No, that makes sense.
All right. So incubation. Sorry, I just saw this comment.
Oh, yeah.
Vermiculite or perlite for incubation. So I generally was using, vermiculite, and then I did a mixture of vermiculite and perlite, and I feel like I liked that. You can incubate just on perlite in itself and have good results too. I did that with like my Australian frilled dragons, like that's how I incubated their eggs. But with the indigos, it was just I think it was the 50-50 blend the second time, and the first time it was vermiculite, and what did I do? Oh, it was this weird, it was like a terracotta, you know, like terracotta pots. It was like a bunch of those like smashed up into little bits. That's what I used for my first clutch. But I never could find it again at a store like the year after I did it. So I never did it again. And that's why I think I've been kind of like experimenting. Vermiculite, it just feels like weirder, where perlite are like those little stones, so it just feel like it's like easier to like work with. Where like if you're doing vermiculite on its own, it's gonna be like, it's just not gonna be like the right mood for me for like, I don't know, incubation media. It just doesn't feel as like good as like the perlite mix, because I feel like majority of these animals, their like eggs are going to be laid in like sand, soil, like clay, almost like feeling substrate. So just getting kind of like close to that is what I try to do for them. So right. You can do a little of both. Do whatever like makes you happy. I think I'm going to be doing just mostly perlite with a little bit of vermiculite this year, just because I live in like the desert. So it's like super dry here, and I want to make sure that they have enough humidity. A big thing though with indigo eggs, just like a side note, is you don't want them to get like too humid in incubation. And I would honestly have to like look up the gauge again, because if they do get too humid, they can like burst. And you don't want that to happen to the babies. I guess it just like being too humid, it causes like pressure to build up in the eggs, and it can cause them to like burst.
Okay. And what is your standard incubation temperature for those eggs?
So temperature was 74 to 76. And I literally incubated like my apartment. So my apartment for the entire 115 days was incubated, like fluctuating from those temps. Sometimes okay. It would get up to 80. It would never go over that. And it would never go under 72.
Interesting.
I know with the indigos, I want to say if it's over 80 degrees, consistently, they can develop spinal deformities. I think it was like 78 to 80 degrees and higher.
Oh, really?
They can develop spinal deformities, just because you're like pushing them to grow like too fast, I guess. But then, when they're too cool, obviously like the embryos like don't develop at all. But you kind of just want to have like that fluctuation from like 74 to 78. And I feel like that's like the sweet spot. Any natural fluctuation I think is good for like colubrid eggs, just for like creating stronger individuals. I don't think I have like any like science to like back that, but I just feel like there's natural drops in the wild, and there can be natural drops in captivity. So I just tried not to like stress myself out. 'Cause 115 days was just like killer. I just was
standard time?
Yeah, you're looking at like 100 to 115 days, sometimes even longer, with some of these like clutches. The babies just definitely like once they do pip, they just take time to like absorb. And I think that's what like takes them so long from like coming out in general, or like to begin hatching in general, is like they're big babies. They're like big, robust babies.
Yeah.
And I think they just take time because they are just like a unit.
Yeah.
They have big heads. Cool. Their heads are like as big as like my thumb when they come out, which is like crazy to me. Because like most colubrids, they have really like tiny heads. Yeah. And these guys just have like these fat, like bulldog heads. And I kind of want to, with this year, do some like note taking and see if there's like a sexual dimorphism, like even at a young age with them, and see if like the males have like bigger heads once they're out of the eggs than the females do. 'Cause I mean, honestly, when they're like 6 months old, sometimes you'll start to notice like a difference. Definitely at a year, the females just have such like a smoother like front of their nose, and everything just like much like rounder almost. And the males have like a almost like a pointier nose, not like pointy like a rhino viper or like a rhino rat or anything like that.
Yeah.
But it's definitely just like a different like head shape, where I'm like, okay, you have a boy head. And I've noticed it more and more as I've had different clutches, but it's pretty interesting to see. So I'd like to see if I could tell when they're like right out of the egg, like, hey, that's a boy, hey, that's a girl. Because with them, it's nothing to do with like their tail base or structure. I had so many people lie to me, like when I bought indigos, so everything that I bought was opposite of what it was sold to me as. So that's really how I ended up with 2.3, because everyone told me it was like the opposite. And then I kind of just like collected them over time, but people would say to me, oh, this one's tail structure, how long it is, that has to do with if it's a female or not. And none of that's true. And one of my males, because of the immense scale rot that he had to have part of his tail like amputated, just like the end of it, right. not close to like his vent or anything. But so he's got like a little nub tail. So like if that were to happen just in different circumstances and like you weren't able to tell, like you could tell based off of his head structure that he's a male, gotcha. When he's like next to a female. And so, and I think it's just from being around them over time too. And just being around them all the time and observing them all the time that I notice like those differences. But I can be like, obviously I pair them up so I know, but if I had them all like in an enclosure, I would be able to tell like which snake is which just based off of like the looks of them, because they all have these unique attributes to them, and the males especially, just how pronounced their head structure is compared to the females is just very different. Like I have one female that it's like she almost has like hooded eyes, like she's got big eyes, but it's like set back a little bit. She's got, I like say like a pug face almost, like,
okay.
And I've seen it with other indigos as well. So I think it's just some come out looking that way. It's not my favorite look. But I will say like her daughter, cause she was the one that gave me my first clutch. Her daughter Warhol, her face is perfect. No bug eyes. There's no like lifted brow almost. And okay. It's not bug eye like a palmetto or anything. I don't want people thinking that she's just like this genetically inferior indigo. She just has a different head structure than what I see with like my typical females. But I have seen it in other females, so I know it's not like atypical, and the fact that I shouldn't be breeding her.
Yeah.
I don't want the colubrid people coming for me.
No. I don't think so. What have your adults topped out at in terms of size?
So males, they're going to stop at about 5 feet. Females, they're generally around 4 feet. I know big females can get around 4.5 feet. And that's specifically for the locality of the Gueros. So Veracruz are the biggest of the locality. And then Sonora is like the next. So I have heard of 6 foot Veracruz, and sometimes even bigger. Have I seen them? No. But I have heard that they do have a substantial like size difference, and they're closer to your like Texans in like girth and length.
Okay. That's interesting. I didn't even know that. I just know that blacktails and yellowtails get like huge.
10 feet plus.
I thought they were getting towards the same range, but I wasn't 100% sure.
No, I tell people I breed pocket dry Marcon. I do the same with like my boas, because I'm trying to work with boa sigma, so the Mexican west coast like constrictor, I think it is like their common name.
Okay.
They're called Sonoran boas. But I breed those too, and I always tell people they're pocket boas because like adult size is typically around 4 feet.
You can still
get a boa constrictor, but not have to have like a 9 foot or even a 7 foot plus like constrictor. Cause like those animals, like just from working in a zoo setting, like we had a BCI. I think he was Peruvian. Don't quote me on that. But he was in, that had to be like a 10 foot by 12 foot enclosure. And he was in like with the anaconda, which like wasn't my favorite thing, but whatever. But just seeing that animal able to like stretch out and display itself and be able to use like every inch of that enclosure, just to see them in like a 4 foot enclosure in someone's like house is just kind of like, ugh. But then if I see a Sonoran boa that is in like a 6 foot enclosure and it's able to, you know, move around and live its life, and you take it out sometimes so it gets enrichment in that way. Like, I really think like that's just such more of a appropriate pet for like majority of people who are just like trying to keep them as like pets and not breed them and do certain things. Cause I think BCCs and BCIs like are incredible. And I think that the people that breed them are awesome for, you know, working with those animals. I just think they can be like a handful of an animal for majority of like new keepers in general.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I, like I said earlier on, is I focused my collection kind of based on like what I was passionate about, but what also is like a practical pet for getting people, you know, passionate about these animals and just giving them the ability to like keep them a lot easier than other stuff and still have a good experience.
Definitely. Cool. Let's see. Is there anything I didn't touch on when it comes to your dry Marcon that's like important information that we kind of missed in terms of general info?
I feel like anyone that is getting into dry Marcon that they should, you know, reach out to like the people that are more vocal about educating people about them. Because I do feel, and this can just be like my personal experience, but I felt like it was very gatekeepy. And I felt like I struggled really hard to get anyone to even like notice like that I was like serious and like I wasn't just like getting a snake and be like, oh, I'm gonna breed it, like this will be whatever. Like, I mean, dry Marcons were the first snake that I did breed, but it was because like I was super passionate about it and I'm like, oh my god, these animals are incredible and I want to have, you know, babies of an animal that I've raised and just all of those like different things. But I feel like ask those questions, don't feel afraid to be like looking stupid in any way, because that's like how we're gonna learn about them. Because like I know like there was this time I heard that this guy didn't want to like give information on like breeding or how he kept them because he didn't think that everyone should have a dry Marcon, and I think that's the stupidest thing he could have ever said or like done, because you're doing that animal and that species a disservice. You want to educate people as much as possible, and you want people to think it's the coolest animal ever, because then people are going to respect that animal. You don't see people, you know, putting a Bolin's python in a rack and giving it just a hide in a water dish and just leaving it alone and spraying it here and there. Like, you know, they're treating that animal to a standard that all animals deserve to be treated as. But I think when you are gatekeeping from people and not wanting to teach people about these animals, it's going to deter them from even knowing that these animals are cool, thinking that they do fall in the lines of, oh, they're shit cannons. Oh, they're dirty. Oh, they're aggressive. Oh, they're this. Oh, they're that. And it's like, instead of like letting that stigma sit, get on camera and educate people how they're not like that. Now, do they poop and are they messy? Yes. Sometimes when I feed them. When you, what goes in must come out. And I think that's to be said with any other snake. They just have a really fast metabolism. And I think that was something where I just was accepting of that, because I've always liked lizards and lizards have crazy fast metabolisms. So I always say like monitor people would be great dry Marcon people, because they're used to that like fast metabolism and having to clean, but they're also very intelligent animals and they're easy to interact with and they're easy they make it easy to work with them because they are just an incredible animal. And so Emilio here, he's breeding ball pythons and his dry Marcon are already being awesome because they eat any stillborns you have, they eat any excess, they're the garbage disposals of nature. And that in itself too is a plus for them. Like, and so it's like any breeder that is getting clutches with stillborns, boa breeders, you would benefit from having a dry Marcon in your collection because nothing's wasted. And I think that's just like, that's so cool. So to sit at home and not tell anyone about how cool these animals are, or to not give them the advice on breeding or keeping them, I think is just asinine. And I just think it does that animal a disservice. And if you really love that animal and you're really passionate about that animal, you're going to speak up for that animal. You're going to educate for that animal, because they can't go and give an educational conference on how they live and how they breed and how they do things. But like, you have the voice to do that. So if you have the passion and that respect for that animal, I just feel like it's a no-brainer. So yeah, I feel like, I don't know if that's like in touch with like indigos in themselves, but it's just that community overall with DrymerCon. I just want to tell people that, like, anyone that is interested in them to reach out and to ask questions and to find those good people, because like, once you have one, you're going to want more. Like, they're addictive.
Yeah.
It's a great, great, great animal to have in any reptile keeper's collection. And I know I'm biased, but I feel like you don't know unless you try. And I don't think I've had anyone ever come to me after buying one of my animals and say like, hey, like, this isn't for me. It becomes like the favorite animal in their collection. And that's all I ever like want for that animal.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that point was well said, because it's true. I mean, they could definitely be more popular in the industry. I'm not sure why they're not.
Because of those old men that are just like, oh, they're stinky. Oh, they bite at you. Oh, they're this. Oh, they're that. And then it's like, then I see like how all these people have been keeping them and they're shoved in racks and they're kept on Aspen and they're just like, they're just not treating them good. And it's like, I would be an asshole too. I'd bite you too. Like, honestly, like if I'm that bored all day and that's the only stimulation I have, like, I can understand why they have the reputation that they do, but that's why I want to be here and at the forefront to like tell people like how different they are. And I think, again, when you give something a good environment to flourish, you're going to get good results.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think as we see time go on and new generations of the hobby come in, we'll see, you know, these types of things change, like you're talking about. We'll see them gain more popularity. You're breeding your Rubidus, so you being that forefront of that species, like that helps out a lot. So, yeah.
I'm happy to do so. I feel very, very blessed that he came into my life in 2020 and like totally changed. Because like, I really wasn't like that heavy into reptiles, and I kind of just went full send after that, because they're different like anything else. And I've always been fascinated with elapids. Like, I know this is stupid, but I'd love a forest cobra. Like, I think they are just one of the most incredible animals to look at. But I don't want to die. So I just feel like working with something that is so close to being elapid like, but having no venom is just like the perfect trade-off for me. And then I'll probably have my Bittus nasicornis in the future, my rhino viper, but at least like, it's not going to be like a 10-foot elapid like flying through my reptile room.
Definitely. I mean, the Kribos, I know Emilio has said that too. Like, he says like, I love cobras, and this is probably like the closest thing I could get to being a non-venomous cobra-ish animal, the Kribos.
Yeah, and I feel like he probably can, like, you know, agree with, like, he didn't realize it until he, like, worked with them hands-on. Because, like, when you go to a show and you hold them and interact with them, it's, like, one thing. But when you own an animal like that and work with it every single day, it's just, like, it's just a completely different experience that, I think that's like why, like when we were at Pomona and he started talking to me about DrymerCon, like I just like lit up because I was like, oh, it's another one. Like, I was excited to have someone part of like my group that experienced it and like that like knows what it's like to work with those animals, because it is just like something where like I can talk about it all day until like my face turns blue. But like working with them hands on is just like something that's like completely different. And that's why I just tell every single person, like, if you're committed and you are breeding stuff and you have room to do, you know, a 6x2x2 or at least a 4x2x2 for the Rubidus, for an Eastern, you always want to go bigger. But if you can do that for that animal, like, you're not going to be disappointed by adding that animal to your collection. It's going to be one of the best like investments you can do just to feel good as a keeper too, to like recycle animals that are stillborns.
Right.
Throwing them in the trash, and like you can only do so many like preserved animals and jars and this and that. And it's just like, it's a way to like give back to nature in like a weird sense, I feel like. And rather than just flushing that animal or throwing it in the garbage, I don't know. I just feel like giving that as a meal to an animal that's going to utilize like all of those nutrients, like, is just such a better thing overall.
Yeah, definitely. All right, cool. And I know we were talking about it a little bit before we went live, but you do have some other colubrid interests as well, at least in small stages at the moment. But you have a member of probably the favorite genus of the channel. You have a Gonyosoma, an oxycephalum. Hold on, let me try to find that one again. You have a really cool looking one too.
Thanks. Yeah, he really caught me off guard. He was at an import table in Cali, and he was $125, and I saw blood all over his container, and that's what like caught my eye. I was like, what the heck's going on here? But he's got some really unique like blue speckling on him now, and yellow speckling as well. He's just, I think it's the one over that's with him. Yeah,
my bad.
So yeah, that's how he acts now. Now he's a lot more relaxed. Like, he's actually out like displayed usually every day now. He lays out on his logs and is a lot more confident, and he'll like dangle down, which I don't know if that's like a feeding behavior or what, but he'll just like completely, he'll have his tail hooked anchored to the top, but then just like hang. And then his head is kind of just like dropped a little bit. So I don't know if he's like, that is like a hunting behavior they do or what it is. I've never really seen one hang like that before, even when I worked at the zoo with the two big females, because those females were probably about 7 feet each, maybe. I would say 7 foot. When I started working there, maybe 6 foot. But they were big girls, and they would always like sit up and coil or like stretch out, but they never like hung like that. So it's just been an interesting behavior he exhibits that has just been kind of like intriguing to me. That's why I got into, or I did pick him up as quickly as I did, was because I have worked with him before and I've always been fascinated with him. Nice. The girl I worked with at the zoo has him tattooed on her. They're just a very awesome snake. Like, they have really cool personalities. I was telling you off camera that the two females we had were like produced from the Fort Worth Zoo in Dallas. So, it was cool to have captive bred individuals as well.
Yeah.
Where we were talking about, they aren't as flighty. They're a little bit more like inquisitive. I think the big thing that attributed to like our females' behavior of not being as normal with like being interacted with was the fact that we were hands off, really, not like on purpose at the zoo, but they kind of just were in a big exhibit and we let them do their thing. So the only type of interaction we had for them was pulling them off for veterinarian care, like their checkups or weights, and then for feeding. Because we would have to sometimes, like if someone just wasn't behaving, we would have to pull someone off to feed them, just because it was a cohabbed enclosure with two Halmahera scrubs, two Aru green tree pythons, and then it was the two red tail rat girls.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. So,
it was such a cool like exhibit just to see the natural behaviors and how they did interact with each other.
Scrubs, green trees, and red tail rats.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. I don't advise people to do it like in
captivity. Definitely not. How big of an enclosure was that?
So it had to be like 6 feet deep, and like 4 feet wide, and then probably like 8 feet tall. And that was like one of my favorite things about it, was you would go in and in the morning, the Halmaheras would be up at the top, just coiled up. And then a red tail rat would be like sitting on top of them or just like poking their head out. And then a lot of the times, one of the females, she always was underneath the substrate and like poking her head out in the morning when I got there. They kind of like had like their like behavioral patterns and like their routines. And it was really cool to see how they like interacted. But I think working with them is just what, because I had my indigos before I like worked at the zoo, but working with them made me like more interested in the gaños, like in particular. I really wanted a rhino. And I still kick myself to this day because Russ Gurley had like the perfect one on his table at a Tinley. And I was the dumbass and bought like Cuban false chameleons. And I should have just bought that snake from him because that snake is no longer alive. You gotta get a rhino. Yeah. So it was like a blue one.
I promise you won't regret it. I promise you will not regret it.
Are you a big fan of those guys?
I have three now. Yeah, okay. They're the only ganyo I have. Three. They're awesome. Yeah.
They're communal too, right? Like do you keep them together?
Not yet, just because they're not at like the same size. I have an adult female, a juvenile male, and then a hatchling female, so they're all at different life stages, but yes, when they do get to adult size, like most people keep their pairs cohab like year round.
That's so cool. Yeah, those guys in particular, I just think they're just such a cool like display animal, and they're just so fascinating. And I've always been obsessed with like rhinoceroses, so like anything that like resembles any type of like rhino, I just think they're just such a unique species, because it's like, why do you need that like type of structure? It's just always just so interesting to me how those animals are created. And I definitely am a fan of those. I think seeing those in like cohab cages, and then the Barons racers, I know they're not, but they have the same structure, a smaller structure, but just they're communal as well, and seeing those displayed together is just such a cool, just a cool animal overall to see. I really do like the Janes and I. Those impress me with like their attitude, and just like the way they present themselves to very cool snake. I like their threat displays, and anything that has like just like that spice to it is always just an intriguing colubrid for me. I do want to work with the Mullendorfi, the 100 flower rat snake. I've wanted one for years, and then I started getting all upset because like they were getting posted on social media and like everyone's getting them, and I was just like, oh, it's like another trend animal. But I think I would get them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who you're seeing with them, but like they go for a lot. They're expensive. Like if you're gonna get a Mullendorf, like you're paying some serious cash, because there's just not a lot of people breeding them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then with the
They're hard. I don't know if you've talked to, is it Matt Most who produces them?
Yeah.
Has he told you any, because I've heard that they're a difficult species to produce, and I can't remember if it's something to do with like the males, or what it is.
You know what? I had Matt on, and we specifically talked about the Mullendorfs, and I'd have to go back and listen to it a little bit. But I think it's just people haven't really worked with them. Like other breeders, like haven't just worked with them enough, perhaps because, you know, they're in the same category as a bunch of our other Asian rat snakes, and people produce others no problem. So
yeah.
They get a little bit bigger, like they get on the bigger side. So I don't know.
Yeah, they're impressive. They're a really unique looking animal. It's definitely one that like caught my attention, because I feel like I'm very picky about like what I want to add to my collection these days. And that's a snake that it always catches my attention when I see one up for sale. And then I always have to tell myself to be responsible, because they are just, they're cool snake for sure.
Yeah. All right, Brooke. I kind of want to go through my wrap-up questions with you. So firstly, what would you say, you know, you've been in this, I guess, kind of a shorter period of time, but what would you say is a big motivator for what really keeps you going with the reptiles overall? I mean, there's a whole lot of noise, expenses, there's social media keep up, all that stuff. But what really keeps the fire burning to keep these reptiles?
I feel like it is the individual species and animals that I keep. I'm super passionate about them. They teach me something new every day. I wake up and I'm excited to work with them. And I feel like as like when you're working with these types of animals, that's just like really important to prevent like the burnout from happening. But yeah, I think that's my answer, is just staying passionate about the stuff that I do like, being humble in the fact where like if something isn't making me happy anymore, knowing that I need to part with it and find it a home where it's going to be like important with the next person. Just constantly allowing myself to grow and change as a keeper, and never being like stagnant in the fact where I'm like, this is the only way to do something. Yeah. I feel like the animals humble you, and the minute that you think you know something or you're perfect at something, they're going to show you that there's something different. So just keeping my ego in check and then making sure that I'm always here to work for the animals and that I'm never thinking of like their breeding for me or doing these things for me, because right. They don't have to do those things. I just want them to do those things.
100%. Yeah. Cool. What would you say the shorter term future, like the next 3 to 5 years, looks like for you and your collection?
That I have no idea. Things are kind of like up in the air for me right now. I'm always going to be producing indigos. And then I'm always going to have like my cyclera. But I feel like just depending on different moves that I make in my life right now, it's just going to depend on that. But yeah, for sure, we'll always have my indigos. And I don't foresee me ever like parting with my original group of chameleon geckos, just because I've had them for so long now that, but maybe downsizing and ends like of not needing 3 producing groups and just having like 1 or 2 producing groups. But yeah, just wanting everyone to be upgraded, have beautiful enclosures, producing majority of my own food. So like, I breed the mice and softers with Steven. Yeah. And then I just got quail recently, and I'm excited to breed those. But yeah, just expanding my knowledge of things and doing stuff for myself, and learning new supplements and different things to do for the animals. Like I've been doing vitamins for the snakes, and then I've also been doing like kelp and Himalayan salt as like supplements for the animals, and just experimenting and trying to give them the healthiest life in captivity possible.
Yeah, 100%. Awesome. And then my last and final question that I ask is, so let's say you're talking to someone and they're either looking to get their first reptile, or they're someone who keeps reptiles but they're looking to get their first colubrid. What's your elevator pitch for why colubrids, or in your case, why the indigos?
Indigo snake can be great for someone that like is older and they want their first snake. I definitely wouldn't say it's for every younger person. But I would say colubrids are the best intro snake possible for a kid, because they don't live 60 some years like some of these ball pythons and other species can live. So if the kid wants to just experiment, they'll have a corn snake for like 15, 20 years. Not even that long sometimes. So the capabilities of what you can do and see if that passion is something that's like serious with you and you want to do it more in the future or not, it's a great dipping your toes in the water experience of learning reptiles and snakes overall. And colubrids, there's such an array of them. And I think that especially because we're in, you know, North America and having as many like native species as we do, it's so much easy to house these animals because it's very similar to their like natural environments. So it sets that person up for success more. And then a lot of these colubrids aren't big bodied animals. So you're not having to provide these like massive, unrealistic enclosures, where for, you know, like a 4-person household, having a big massive enclosure just isn't always like what's going to happen for some of these kids, especially, or people that are younger getting animals and living with a family. So it's just like important, to be realistic about what you can provide and the others living around you, like what you can do. And I think with colubrids, you just have more of that ability to do those things or check all of those boxes, I guess. I just think like a Pidgeophis, for example, is like a perfect beginner snake. For kids, it teaches them about, because Pidgeophis can be kind of hissy and there are a lot of like bark, no bite, but it teaches a individual how to work with an animal, how to switch them out of like, you know, a feeding response, or how to switch them out of like a defensive posture. It teaches you how to work an animal that if it does bite you, it's not gonna hurt like hell. To be honest, like I have been bit by some bigger stuff and it's not my favorite thing in the world, but getting bit by a colubrid isn't really that big of a deal, unless it is like a rear fanged or like, you know, the different categories that can exist within colubrids. But generally speaking, majority of colubrids are very easy. They're hardy. And they teach you just like the basic knowledge of caring for any type of snake or reptile, I guess, in general. Not all the care parameters for like a lizard, but they will teach you just general care aspects of different snake species and in betweens.
Definitely. All right, cool. Well, Brooke, this was a fantastic episode. I think that wraps it up for tonight. Before I let you go, I have the link to your Instagram in the description. That'll be on YouTube and the podcasting platforms. Anywhere else people can reach you or anything else you want to say before we end this?
So I'm on TikTok and YouTube and Facebook as well. It's all under the same Brooke Elder or Bow Lizard. It's going to be the same like across the board. But no, I think we're all set. I really appreciate you having me. And I was
absolutely very thank you for coming on
excited to talk about DrymarCon. And I appreciate everyone who tuned in tonight and listened to me ramble about some of my favorite things.
Yeah, definitely. No, well, thank you so much. Like I said, DrymarCon episode was well overdue. So thank you for helping to fill in the gap. So, Yeah. All right, cool. I'm going to let you hang out in the backstage for a couple minutes. If you want to wait, we'll just chat for a couple minutes afterwards.
Sounds good.
All right, cool. Thanks. All right, guys. What another great episode of the Colubrid Corruption podcast. I hope you all enjoyed tonight's episode. Really in-depth, good information. Brooke has a lot of really cool animals. Takes really good care of them, really nice setup. So yeah, overall, I hope you guys learned something from that one. Once again, guys, if it's your first time tuning in or not, make sure you hit that like button here on YouTube. Make sure you hit the subscribe button. Once again, we're pushing to that 1100 subscribers. Feel free to join the Meteoric Serpents Patreon. That's the first link in the description below. Listen to us on all the major audio platforms. Again, Apple, Spotify, YouTube Music, all that good stuff. I think that does it all for tonight. So once again, guys, thank you so much. This was episode number 62 of the Colubrid Corruption podcast with Brooke Elder. I hope you all have a great night. Fantastic rest of your day whenever you're listening to this. And we will catch you next week. Peace.